Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. While many businesses in Pennsylvania have closed to slow the spread of the coronavirus, Governor Tom Wolf and First Lady Frances Wolf reminded Pennsylvanians that this doesn't include grocery stores and food suppliers. Governor Wolf said that all Pennsylvanians should have faith in our food system and that if everyone only buys what they need, there will be enough for everyone. Since the outbreak began, there have been shortages of certain products like toilet paper and cleaning supplies, leaving some uneasy about the reliability of the food supply. Will there be enough food during the COVID-19 emergency? Joining us today is Scott Carnes, CEO of Carnes Quality Foods. Mr. Carnes, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Great to hear you.
Also, Joe Fasula, owner of Garrity's Grocery Stores, represent in northeastern Pennsylvania. Mr. Fasula, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Both of these gentlemen are representing the Pennsylvania Food Merchants Association. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Scott Carnes, let me start with you. I'll ask both of you this question. Is there enough food continuing to come into your stores to feed customers during the coronavirus emergency?
Absolutely. You may not find the exact item that you want or particular product, but food-wise, we're in excellent shape. I will tell you, as you said, there are commodities that are non-food products that are in short supply.
Are there any food items that are in short supply?
Like I said, there are no basic food items are out in short supply. We have great supplies of produce, fresh meats, seafoods, deli items. But, like, there are canned pastas that are running short. You know, we're just on allocation and we're not getting as much because the consumers are buying so much. And I think it's because the students are home from school. So a lot of those, what I call family core items, are really hard for us to come by.
Mr. Garrity,
we have a separate supplier from Scott, so I think it's a good perspective. We have pretty much the same exact experience so far that Scott's been having. It's a pretty good flow. Food items are not a problem as long as you're willing to accept different sizes or different brands. But it is challenging and it is frustrating not to be able to give the customer what they're looking for.
So, Joe Fasula, talk about, you know, we are in a position where we don't know how long this will last. Are you confident that will continue if this emergency lasts for weeks, maybe even months?
As long as people keep going to work. Our employees, I know, are very tired. I know employees throughout the entire food distribution chain are getting really overworked. I don't know how long they can keep it up. And then you also have the factor of employees that are getting a little afraid, and we really haven't had too many cases in our area yet, and thank God none in our industry locally. So I don't know what will start happening once that occurs, and as the different workers throughout the entire different sections of the food chain start dropping, that could be the only concern. And I think it's really important that our government does everything they can to continue to encourage people to go to work in the various different components of the food chain.
When you say your employees are getting a little afraid, what do you mean? What have they said to you?
Well, they're concerned about the fact that they're dealing with the public on a daily basis. And, of course, you don't know who could be infected and who could be bringing it in. So it is a bit of a concern, especially if they have, and it's really the ones who are either over 60 years of age or, you know, either they themselves or family members have some sort of potential compromising issue.
Scott Carnes, what about you? I actually was in one of your stores on Saturday, and everything seemed to be normal as far as communicating with the employees. But have they expressed the same kind of concerns? And the next question is, what are you doing, I mean, as managers of the stores, to make sure that your employees are safe?
Well, our staff has been phenomenal throughout this. I mean, as Joe said, they are working incredible amounts of hours. And fatigue is a big issue, but they are also concerned with the virus coming up. So we're doing well in that aspect. We have glove supplies, sanitation supplies. We encourage them to take hand washing breaks. We're doing as much as physically we can do in that area, but unfortunately, we are still dealing with the general public. And as I said before, they're doing a phenomenal job out there under the stress that they're under, and it is long hours, 7 days a week. We did close early to add in additional sanitation procedures and to give them a chance to restock and prep the store. So we have closed our hours down a little bit in addition to give those opportunities just to do a better job.
What kind of addition? Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, we're doing the same thing. We're closing early and doing everything we can to give them some breaks. But it's challenging. They're having a tough time.
What kind of additional sanitation routine?
So, like we do, we have special times where they're wiping down. Every night we have sanitized solutions that we spray onto all of our carts, handle areas, just general public areas, to give it an extra step and an extra defense against this virus and to maybe stop one case from expanding out there.
Are employees in either of your stores, and we're talking about grocery stores across Pennsylvania representing the Pennsylvania Food Merchants Association, but I could also just talk specifically about your stores and then maybe what some others are doing. But are there employees who are wearing masks or want to wear masks?
We do have employees that want to wear masks. We allow them to wear those masks. We are telling them to wear gloves. We've gotten in extra supplies of gloves and extra supplies of hand and sanitation. So we are definitely, and I'm talking wearing gloves for everyone, the person who's going out into the parking lot to pick up the excess carts and bring them back. I want them wearing gloves. So we are doing those kind of steps and encouraging them to do that. And then as the governor keeps saying, wash your hands, and we're encouraging them to do that.
Joe?
Yeah, the challenge with the masks is that we can't get them. So if an employee has a mask and can get a mask, we're allowing them to wear them. And some have said, can we get masks? And unfortunately, I can't get any.
Well, another question I had for the two of you, though, when it comes to mask or protective equipment, there have been some stores, and I don't know whether this is in Pennsylvania, but across the country, that where employees have been discouraged from wearing protective gear like gloves or mask because of the message that it sends to customers. Does that concern you at all?
No, and the customers haven't reacted at all to it. The first time I saw an employee wearing a mask, I was a little unnerved by it. But the customer, and he was a cashier, the customer was just going through the line. Nobody seemed to even flinch at it. And I think they appreciate that we're giving the employees the opportunity to keep themselves safe. And of course, that goes both ways. An employee who's wearing gloves and a mask has less opportunity to infect you, too.
Mm-hmm. Scott, what about that?
Yeah, we're having no problem at all with that. I actually encourage them to do what makes them comfortable. Certainly, we've all heard that unless you have that super mask, that it's really not a strong barrier. But it does encourage people from touching their face or maybe touching nose or eye areas. So we have no problem with that. One item that, Scott, that we have added into our stores is we have placed decals throughout the stores saying, encouraging social distancing to stop here. Before you move forward at checkout. So we are adding in those types of things just to give everybody a little bit more space in the store. It wasn't something that was possible the last 2 weeks when the crowds were exorbitant and huge out there. But we have put in the decals, and the customers seem to be following these decals.
It's something you're talking about there, Scott. We have heard stories from both sides, extremes, where the public has been very understanding. There have been so many examples of people being giving, being polite, helping their neighbor. Of course, then we have heard stories of other people where customers have been kind of short-tempered when they can't find something that they want or, there is a limit on what they can buy. Have either of your stores experienced either one of those.
Sure, but it's absolutely the exception. The vast majority, and I'm going to say it's probably in the 90 to 95%, have been very polite, very appreciative, very accommodating, and very understanding. There really hasn't been much of a problem in that. And I've given my managers the authority to tell someone they're not welcome to come back, because right now there's so much tension, there's so much fear, there's so much stress. We just don't need that in the store. So I am not concerned about that continuing.
Scott?
Yeah, it's been, the customers have been exceptional. They have been, you know, and when you say, I'm going to say to Joe, it's probably 99%+ of the customers are just so glad that we're open. There are those 1% of the people who are problem people, you know, that have complaints about issues being out of stock, or it's too crowded, or you're not serving people quick enough. And yes, we have asked people to leave the store because of rude behavior, because my staff doesn't have to put up with that.
Question here from a listener. Are your stores hiring with long hours and other types of businesses out of work? Can they hire more workers?
Well, we are hiring, but, you know, there is that curve to get somebody up to train when it's,
yes,
a skill position,
correct,
like a bakery or meat cashier. Those, you know, you just don't instantly take that position on. So we are hiring for those positions. We have added in staff since then. But I don't want to take on too many people. Yes, there's a surge in business because I want to take care of those that are here. But we do have help wanted signs up at all locations.
I just been handed a note that Pennsylvania's Attorney General Josh Shapiro just tweeted that they are finding instances of price gouging around the state in pharmacies and grocery stores. Is there a commitment to maintaining reasonable prices and not raising prices for the sake of profit?
I've given instructions to all of my buyers, all of my operations people, that we're going to keep our sale prices up. We're going to honor all sales that have been advertised unless our cost goes up substantially. And we are starting to see some markets move. And the way we're going to handle that is what I've told them in the past, is the supermarket generally works on percentages of profit. But we're going to throw that out the window. And what I've told them was, whatever percentage you had on the lower price and whatever penny profit that equated to, I want you to maintain that penny profit or less, because obviously if you apply a percentage to a larger number, you're going to end up with more profit, and we do not want to do that. Now, interestingly, we actually had one of our stores that had chicken that was put out, and it was mispriced at $15 a pound.
Whoa.
And, oh, yeah.
Some,
yeah,
good was, chicken.
Like, yeah, yeah. There was about 6 or 7 packs of chicken that were put out. And it was supposed to be, I believe it was like a $1.50 something a pound discount. But they put it in at a retail and added an extra zero. So it was a disaster. And, of course, the customer, instead of just asking, posted it on Facebook. So I lost my mind with that. I feel very confident to say, and I'm shocked to even hear that there would be instances of that. I would imagine that as those are investigated, they're either going to be found to be mistakes or they're going to be found to be some sort of, very odd misunderstanding. I can't imagine anybody in our position right now doing that. I mean, first of all, we're doing a lot of business. I mean, how much could you possibly need to make? Our job right now should be making sure that we're keeping our prices as low as we can, especially as people start running out of money because they're not working.
Scott?
You know, we're in a business. We've been here for 60 years. So many of the food industry's businesses have been around for a long time, and they didn't get in business and stay in business by fraudulent practices. Will mistakes be made? As Joe said, of course, there could be mistakes both ways, up and down. But I don't feel like there's any fraud going on, any price gouging. You know, we're still running ads. And there's right now, because of restaurants being closed, there's actually some prices that are just going down quite a bit. And we're passing along those great prices because there's an excess supply. Yes, there are other categories that are going up in price right now. I'll give you an example. Eggs go up. But you know what? It's Easter and Passover, a time when eggs normally go up, and then you have an event like the coronavirus, and it puts extra pressure on that market, and it caused wholesale costs to go up.
How would you compare what's happened over the past 2 or 3 weeks to, say, a snowstorm where people are running in and, you know, we joke about bread and milk, but how would you compare what's happened over the last 2 or 3 weeks to a snowstorm?
Well, to me, it's been like, the old movie we saw of Groundhog Day. It just happens day after day after day. 2 weeks ago, I had told my staff to expect this to be like a 12-inch snowstorm, and it's like a 48-inch snowstorm that just keeps coming and coming, but the customers keep coming. We did some pre-buying, pre-planning, but we were woefully short.
I don't think there's any way to prepare for this. And what we've said is 2 years ago, there was a snowstorm in our area that was predicted to come on, I think it was Super Bowl Sunday. It was supposed to come.
I remember that.
And that was probably one of the busiest days we've ever had. And it has been like that almost every single day since this started.
Mm. Now, I'm assuming your stores had runs on toilet paper and cleaning products. When this emergency began 2 or 3 weeks ago, were customers buying packages, multiple packages of toilet paper?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I mean, there was no doubt about it. You know, we did put up limits, but they would buy the limits, we're not in a situation, nor is any store in a situation, where there's excess buys when people are hoarding items to ever catch up on that.
How do you enforce those limits? I mean, you guys are not police officers or anything like that. If someone sees that you can buy one roll of toilet paper, one package of toilet paper, and they decide they're not going to pay attention or they're going to go through self-checkout, something like that, how do you enforce that?
It's extremely rare. We've had very, very few customers do that. We have signs all over the store. The cashiers are aware. And at this point, nobody has an excuse to say that they didn't know. If that does happen, though, our store managers will step in.
You know, in a grocery store, customers often pick up items like fruit and vegetables to examine them for quality or to compare. Now, that can't be a good practice during a pandemic. How do you limit that?
You really don't have a way to limit that. And the customers should be doing the same thing they did before the pandemic, Scott, is the best thing for anything. You should always wash and rinse any food product like that. And, yes, you can't do that to a box of cereal if somebody picks that up. But you know, on the consumable-type items like fruits and vegetables, it was before the pandemic, and it still is recommended that you wash and rinse those vegetables for whatever could be occurring, whether it's something that's coming truly from the field.
Let's take a phone call.
Yeah, and we sell a fruit and veggie wash spray that you can spray on your produce.
Hmm. Let's go to a phone call. Tanya in Lancaster. Tanya, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Well, first of all, I applaud these gentlemen and their staff for what they're doing. I do have a question. We're hearing a lot about, staff in groceries being very exhausted and stressed out, and that does lower people's immune response. So I wonder, are you thinking of introducing days to let them recuperate? And also, do you have paid sick days for if they do start having symptoms of being sick?
Thank you very much for your call, Tanya. Gentlemen?
Well, I'll go first and let Joe go then. Of course, we do have paid sick time available for them. We have already reduced our hours, which just, it seems like a minimal, but you reduce the number of hours, that does give us a chance to have more people to in a schedule and to actually blend out the schedule. So right now, just by having that 10%, a little bit over 10% reduction in hours, it has allowed us to give some relief to the number of hours that cashiers are working. And then by having more time to stock, we're bringing in our management and supervisory to help out with stock plans. I've been stocking shelves and working the shelves every day to try to give them assistance so that we can get the jobs done earlier and people can get home earlier.
Joe?
Every store manager and department manager I talk to, I've asked them when they've had their last day off. I've told them they need to make sure that they take time off. There's no reason really why they can't, because at this point, you just have to put everything in perspective and making sure that they can they can survive this, from a stamina standpoint, is so very important.
We have a question here from a listener, Karen in Lancaster, says, I'm concerned about clerks and customers at checkout. Please train baggers to stay 6 feet from customers. I was bagging my own groceries and the bagger should have left to help at another line. Also, what can be done to keep clerks 6 feet from customers?
There isn't really a lot that can be done. Supermarkets are not designed for that. In conventional thinking, supermarkets wanted as much business as we could possibly get all the time, and we wanted to have a very close personal relationship with our customers. So taking a 40,000 square foot facility that was designed to achieve that and trying to turn it over really is just not possible. Now, we have tried to educate our employees. We have signs that we've hung in our stores about cleaning and wearing gloves and changing gloves and also keeping as much space as they possibly can. But unfortunately, there's no perfect solution to that.
Scott? Yeah, the one item that, and I did have customers bring that up, Scott, to us, and I did recommend to that customer that we do have self-checkouts, and I will tell you that our self-checkout usage has climbed significantly in the last 3 weeks.
Gentlemen, we're almost out of time. I want to thank you very much for speaking with us today. Final question. As this continues, can Pennsylvanians feel confident in their food supply and that food and what they need that is necessary during this emergency will continue to be available?
Yes, they absolutely can. Our grocers, the farmers, suppliers are all working to get this out. So the food industry is going to have food out there. There'll just be some gaps and some holes out there. But as far as food and people worrying about is there food to eat, that's not going to be a problem.
Scott Korn,
you have to remember.
Go ahead, Joe.
You have to remember that right now, nobody's going to events, nobody's going to sporting events, nobody's going to all these different places where you would be eating. So all they really need to do is we need to start getting all of that into the food channel, into the grocery channel. So it's not like people are going to eat more, especially now that most people, I think, have stocked up. And if you do live near a grocery store, and everybody usually does, but if you live near a distribution facility, if you know how to drive a truck, please go and apply so that we can get more and more hands helping out.
Scott Carnes, CEO of Carnes Quality Foods, and Joe Fasola, owner of Garrity's Grocery Stores, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And both gentlemen and their stores represent the Pennsylvania Food Merchants Association. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Sorry, I was just a little bit jumpy there. With our coronavirus coverage, our goal is to equip you with the information you need rather than chase every update. We'll try to keep things in context and focus on helping you make decisions. Here's something that I have found particularly interesting, and it's questions that you have had calling in that we have not been able to answer on the air, that we attempt to get answers for those questions. It's at WITF.org. There's a FAQ, Frequently Asked Questions. Just a lot of them that have come in, and we've gotten answers for you. So I encourage you to go to that feature on our website, WITF.org/coronavirus, to see the Frequently Asked Questions section. There is no cure for COVID-19. The first clinical trials for a vaccine to protect against the virus began just over a week ago. Public health officials say it will take a year to 18 months for a potential vaccine to be fully tested. Joining us now is University of Pennsylvania Professor of Biostatistics, Medical Ethics, and Health Policy, Susan Ellenberg. Dr. Ellenberg, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so Dr. Ellenberg, that 12 to 18 months before a vaccine is available and ready for widespread use, do you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely, and I think that's a bare minimum. That's if we're lucky and the very first vaccine candidates that go into study actually turn out to be effective.
Why do you say that? I mean, this is being touted by some people as, you know, we are really rushing this. We're doing our best to get through this and get it into the market even quicker than 12 to 18 months.
Well, of course, we'd all like to have it as soon as possible, but vaccines are given to healthy people. So the first thing you have to make sure is that it's safe. We're all aware of all the concerns that people have had about the safety of vaccines, and this is no different. We first have to make sure that this is safe, that it's not going to hurt people. That takes a little while, and those trials have just gotten started. With the very first candidate coming out of NIH, there are other candidates that vaccine manufacturers are developing. So that process will take a few months. Then they will look to see whether the vaccine is in fact developing the kind of antibodies in people that are thought to be protective. And only then, after the safety has been adequately assessed, can it go into large-scale trials. Now, when you put it into trials, you have a lot of people getting the vaccines and others are getting the placebo, and you have to wait and see how many people actually get infected or even how many actually get sick. To see whether the vaccine is working. And that's not going to be immediate. By the time these trials are being done, we may hopefully not have so much disease and infections out there if what we're doing now to mitigate the transmission is effective. So it may be a while before we know whether the vaccines are really effective.
A typical clinical trial, how long does it take?
Well, it really depends. If we're talking about a clinical trial of a therapeutic, that could be done quickly. If you're looking for something like we are here, where you can tell within a few weeks whether the drug is working. And I think that's the biggest hope right now for doing something about this epidemic, because there are a number of potential treatments that are in trials. Some of them are likely to be finished within a matter of weeks from now. And if we find a good drug that can effectively treat the people who get sick, that'll be really, really important. For the people who get infected, who don't ever have any symptoms or have mild symptoms, you know, it can be like the flu. If we have something to treat people who get really sick, I think we'll have a lot less to worry about. So I think we'll have some information on some of the promising therapies very soon, and for the others that are just getting started, it probably won't take more than 5 or 6 months to finish those trials, because we'll have answers quickly from individual patients.
When you say very soon, some people's very soon is different than others. What do you mean by very
true.
Soon?
well, one of the drugs, remdesivir, an antiviral drug, those trials actually got started in China. When the epidemic was raging in China, and the manufacturer, Gilead, has said that they expect results by the end of April. Remdesivir is also being studied by an NIH trial that's ongoing, and maybe other trials. The WHO is just starting a big global trial that's going to include remdesivir. So we'll have information, I think, on that drug probably first. But there are a lot of other drugs that are in process in trials, and I would expect it will be at least 4 or 5 months before we have information on any of those.
Do those running a clinical trial feel any pressure to get it finished at a time like this during an emergency?
Of course. Everybody involved with this feels enormous pressure, and it's not so different from the way it was, say, 30, 35 years ago when I was working on clinical trials when I was at NIH during the early days of the AIDS epidemic. That kind of pressure we certainly feel now. And so people are doing their best to simplify the processes, make it easier for people to find out about the trials and enter the trials, make the trials easier to do. So I think they will be done efficiently.
When you say you feel that pressure, and you mentioned that you worked on the early days of the AIDS epidemic, what form does that pressure take? I mean, pressure from who, and is it pressure applied on yourself?
Well, everybody, when you have something that's really serious, everybody involved wants to get the answers as soon as possible. If people are dying, you know, and you're involved in doing something to try and mitigate that, you really feel that pressure. You want to help. So what happened within the early days of AIDS epidemic? The very first treatment trial that showed a benefit was the trial of AZT. And that trial was stopped early when it was very clear that many more people were dying on the placebo arm than the AZT arm. What happened? FDA took unprecedented steps to get this drug approved on the basis of less information than they usually have. They opened up an expanded access program so people could get the drug who couldn't be on the trial. So from the manufacturer to the FDA to physicians, everybody did their best to try and get this drug to patients. Now, of course, that particular drug turned out not to be the magic bullet that everybody hoped it was at the beginning. It did prolong life for a short period of time, but not forever, and then other drugs eventually took over.
You mentioned remdesivir. There have been reports that there are some drugs already on the market for treatment of malaria and lupus that may be effective treating COVID-19, but not approved by the FDA. Why is this an issue?
Well, they're approved for use where they've been proven to be effective treatments for other issues. They haven't been studied for this disease, and there are many reasons to be concerned about just willy-nilly giving these drugs to people who are sick. There's already been a couple of reports of harm, I think at least one death, maybe two, of people who are trying to self-medicate with this drug. This drug is available. It's available for the treatment of autoimmune diseases. We don't know whether it works at all for this disease. We don't know what the right dose would be. In people who are very sick, the dose that's used for other people, maybe it's going to be too high and kill them. Maybe it's not going to be high enough to do anything for this particular disease. So we don't know. We don't know how to treat using this. And the best way to find out whether this drug works is to do a clinical trial. And it is going into clinical trials.
Now, what you're talking about with the death yesterday, and I do believe I saw reports of at least two, chloroquine. And the form that the people, at least the one person who died, that this was something that's used to kill parasites in fish. I mean, this can be dangerous. President Trump has mentioned this, and he's touted it, quite frankly. And, I mean, we're talking about two different kinds of substances here. When you're talking about killing parasites in fish and taking this drug for something else, right?
Right. Well, this is the danger in just telling people this is what they should use. We don't know if it's going to work. We don't know if it's going to do more harm than good.
Mm. And so, go ahead. What were you going to say?
I was going to say people who are interested in this should see whether there's a clinical trial, that they could participate in.
Another reaction is that so many people are trying to get these medications is that people who need them are having trouble getting them. I had a friend in Arizona who has rheumatism arthritis and could not for the life of him get that medication Saturday, had to call around the country to get it. And it's creating a shortage for people who actually need it.
Absolutely. This is a big problem. My daughter lives in South Florida, and one of her friends is a pharmacist who says some physicians are ordering huge amounts of these drugs, either chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine, to stockpile for potential because they're expecting to have more patients. So that is, we don't know whether that's going to help the COVID-19 patients, and we do know that the people who have these autoimmune disease who depend on these drugs are not going to be able to get it. So I agree with you. It's a huge problem.
Why would doctors prescribe this medication for treatment of COVID-19?
Well, it's understandable that if you're responsible for treating patients and they're getting sicker and sicker, you want to do whatever you can for them. And this drug is the only one where there's any thought that it might be a treatment, and it's available because it's on the market. So I can understand that. What's the information that tells people it might work? It's only laboratory experiments, in so-called in vitro experiments, where they've shown that these drugs may have some activity against viruses that are like COVID, the virus that's causing COVID-19. So it's a very minimal information, and people should understand that the vast majority of drugs that start out looking promising because of those kinds of laboratory results, the vast majority end up showing that they can't treat the disease. That's the very first step. There haven't even been animal studies using this drug in animals with the coronavirus.
I know that Dr. Fauci, for example, has tried to set people straight during the White House press conferences, but is President Trump making a mistake by talking about these things the way he has?
Well, I think he is. I think he means well. I think he, you know, has been told that these drugs might have some effect and they're available. So again, it's understandable in the same way it's understandable that the physicians who are getting these drugs and using them to try and treat patients, we're all human and we want to help. But you've got to take a step back and look and say, is this really the best way to help? I think it isn't.
You were part of a team that two of your colleagues at the University of Pennsylvania wrote a column, New York Times, that forecasted this would last for at least 8 weeks. I know that wasn't your part of this, but what are your thoughts on it?
Right. Well, right. As I said, I'm not an epidemic modeler. I'm a clinical trials person, but I think this estimate, and it is a very unsure estimate, a very uncertain estimate, but in China, the worst of the epidemic lasted about 6 to 8 weeks before it started to decline. And in Italy, we're in the fourth week, and it looks like maybe they're starting to get over the peak. So, you know, based on things like that, you know, 8 weeks until it starts to go down is a conservative and an uncertain estimate, but it's kind of the best that we have right now. I think as we see things evolving further in China and in Italy, we'll know more. But a concern that we raised in that article, which we're seeing now in Hong Kong, is that if you stop the mitigation too soon, there's still going to be virus out there. There are going to be people who are infected but asymptomatic, don't know that they're infected, are going to pass it on, and we're going to see another spike. And that's what, you know, that's what we call the roller coaster effect. So I think that's a big concern with trying to move too quickly to get back to normal.
University of Pennsylvania Professor of Biostatistics, Medical Ethics, and Health Policy, Dr. Susan Ellenberg. Dr. Ellenberg, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Most of the Americans who have died from the COVID-19 coronavirus have been older or had underlying medical conditions. Even though we are hearing more reports of more younger people getting seriously ill, those over the age of 60 are still considered the most vulnerable. We'll discuss other issues relating to the coronavirus and older Pennsylvanians with Robert Torres, Pennsylvania Secretary of Aging. Secretary Torres, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Secretary, here's a broad question. Older people are considered the most vulnerable. What are you telling older people and those caring for older people during this COVID-19 emergency?
Well, we're advising them to follow the guidance given by the Pennsylvania Department of Health. My colleague, Secretary Levine, usually ends her daily reminders with stay home, stay calm, and stay safe. And I think those are wise recommendations, especially, as you said, since older adults will have a tendency to have underlying medical conditions such as diabetes, heart disease, or lung disease like COPD and asthma, which will translate to very serious complications if they are exposed to the virus.
But the issue with that is that, you know, those things that Secretary Levine and others are advising people, stay calm, stay home, stay safe, that it becomes a challenge for a lot of older people who rely on other people, or maybe their safety or their health is jeopardized to begin with. So they can't all follow the exact same recommendations as everyone else, right?
That's correct. I mean, we took steps to obviously close all the senior centers to avoid exposure on a wider scale, you know, because of, you know, the number of older adults that gather at senior centers. Our area agencies on aging, there's 52 of them across Pennsylvania that service all the counties, are looking out for older adults that are in need, especially since some of them rely on the services of a senior center for their nutrition, for that social interaction that they have throughout a day. So all of the area agencies on aging as part of the closures have submitted contingency plans, and part of that is making sure that the nutritional needs of older adults or daily needs that might go beyond nutrition are being met. And one of the other things that a lot of them are doing is also checking in on them just to make sure that they're doing okay during this time where they're in their home. We have a lot of individuals or, you know, volunteers that are working to support older adults that may be alone and in the home. So we're encouraging family members, friends, neighbors to just periodically check in and see how they're doing and if they may be in need of some support.
Just to clarify, are the area agencies on aging in the counties across the state, they are closed?
No, they're not. They're considered life-sustaining businesses.
Okay.
Again, maybe it might be helpful for your listeners to understand a little bit about what we do at Department of Aging. We provide home and community-based support for older adults, typically over the age of 60, that are not eligible for Medicaid-type services. So these are services that would help them stay independent and support them being at home. We also provide protective services, so that would be reports of any elder abuse, like neglect, exploitation, or physical abuse. We also have a PACE pharmaceutical program, again, for lower-income eligible older adults over 65, for example, I have essential staff working to make sure that we're meeting the needs of individuals who are enrolled in that program. And we have a PA Link program, which is basically an aging and disability resource center. So anyone across Pennsylvania that needs some support can call our PA Link program and, again, get referred to essential support services and resources that they may need and could be of help to them.
What is that number? I know that was a quick question for you. You probably have it in front of you, but we can get...
No, I have it. It's 1-800-753-8827, or they could go to carelink.pa.gov, and they'll get information. That's, the information and referral service that we have.
Secretary, we have a question from a listener. It says, loneliness is a real issue. What would the Secretary recommend for this group of people who are so isolated?
Well, that's been one of our big concerns, especially with the senior centers and adult day centers being closed, making sure that we encouraging families, loved ones, neighbors, or anyone, for example, at the senior centers. The senior center staff are working as well. Some are continuing to provide meals and providing meals instead as congregate meal, where obviously they would be eating as a group. They're providing takeout meals or pickup meals for seniors that maybe live in a high rise that's walking distance and they can pick it up or drive by. We have volunteers that are delivering, although we've seen a drop off in those volunteers, but where there are gaps, for example, in terms of the number of volunteers, we're having them call us. We have our emergency management command center set up at Pima, and there's a lot of resources there where we can quickly try to mobilize support to make sure that the needs of seniors are met. But I would encourage social isolation is a big concern. Probably a lot of anxieties and nervousness with everything that's going on. So if you know someone, a neighbor that's alone, you know, it would be helpful to just call them and see if they're doing okay.
Well, I want to take a step back for something you just said. So you need volunteers. How could someone volunteer?
Well, they could call Serve PA. There's a Serve, SERV.PA.gov. That's one place that you can go to register yourself. This is all being monitored, again, with at the Emergency Command Center at Pima. Or you could you could dial PA211, the 211 number, to see what kind of current opportunities are out there and register either as an individual or as a group. So, you know, a lot of the volunteers are older adults themselves, the ones that are delivering meals. So that's why we've seen a drop-off, and, you know, as much as possible, we're encouraging individuals who are healthy and feel comfortable being able to provide that level of support to do so.
So is food and nutrition the biggest concern?
Well, at the moment it is, yeah, but also making sure that older adults have their medications, that's another big concern. And part of what we've done with our PACE pharmaceutical program is relax our rules. Typically, you have to use up 75% of your prescription before you're allowed refills. So we've relaxed those rules so that anyone who's concerned about not having their medication for the duration of this event can get them refilled with the authorization of their physicians. The only exception to that would be opioids or controlled substance. That would be handled on a case-by-case basis. We're also helping with delivery of medications. So again, if someone's pharmacy is not able to deliver at home and allow that older adult to stay in place, we will look for a pharmacy that can provide that level of support. If your listeners do have any concerns with medications or pharmacy, we have a patient assistance clearinghouse program. So that would go beyond the individuals who are enrolled in the PACE program. They can call with any concerns they have on medication, and our team here does a very good job of trying to connect them with resources and support. I can give you that number if you'd
like. Yeah, sure. I know there's a lot of numbers here, but there probably are a lot of people who this is pertinent to them.
Yeah, so that would be 800-955-0989. And again, all this information is available on our website. But that's an important service. These are services that, you know, I want more people to know about, because they do a good job of connecting to resources, helping, you know, with lower cost medication that can help meet an unmet need out there.
Secretary, you mentioned part of the responsibility of the Department of Aging is to fight against elder abuse. At this time, when there are so many people who are, you know, you're not getting visitors, if you are in assisted living or a nursing home, there are people in who have caretakers not coming into their homes as often, maybe. So how do you protect against it in a situation like this?
Well, we have a 1-800 hotline, so that's typically where we're getting reports of need for protective services. So someone suspects abuse. It's unfortunate because, I've been reading that there are scams and other fraud type of activities out there. So, that's kind of a separate issue, but something else that I want to just alert the listeners to be very careful about, individuals who are trying to engage in fraudulent activities. But with protective services, we're still operational. Our investigators are looking at cases. The only thing we've done is limit the face-to-face contact. So we're suggesting that they go out only for instances where there's imminent harm related to physical or bodily injury or sexual abuse. To the extent they can, get as much information during the intake of any type of case over the phone, request medical records, to be, emailed or mailed so that we can look at what's going on. If it's an incident that happens at a nursing home or some other licensed residential facility, we'll coordinate with Department of Human Services or Department of Health. And the reason we're doing that is to limit the number of people that has to go out. If they're going out as a licensing authority, we may piggyback and ask for their help instead of sending, an extra person from Department of Aging or from the area agencies on aging.
Secretary, I only have a few seconds left. Can you do that? Can you respond quickly to something like that?
Yes. Okay. We have an obligation to. So if it's a serious matter, we will, the staff that handles protective services are working those cases and will continue to do so during this event.
Pennsylvania Secretary of Aging Robert Torres, thank you very much, Secretary, for being with us today.
You're welcome, Scott. Thank you for having me.
And I would encourage everyone, you could probably heard the secretary say that there's a lot of information on the Department of Aging's website. I encourage you to go to that website if you have any questions.